Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of a recent episode exploring the history of investors holding businesses accountable and the dawn of the ESG, or Environmental Social Governance, movement.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. The responsibilities bestowed upon the American presidents have never been more unwieldy, unmanageable, and unrealistic. And it appears that this will only get worse as Americans expect their president to confront and resolve crisis after crisis, and as the power within the executive branch only gets stronger. The presidency is out of control, and if nothing changes, our constitutional democracy is in danger of eroding. So concludes John Dickerson of CBS News, who's been thinking seriously about this even before the norm-busting presidency of Donald Trump. How do we get here, and what can be done to right the ship? This hour on Point, rethinking the expectations and power of the U.S. president. With us now from New Preston, Connecticut, is John Dickerson. He's a correspondent for 60 Minutes and a CBS News political analyst. His new book is entitled The Hardest Job in the World, The American Presidency. And you can find an excerpt at our website at onpointradio.org. John Dickerson, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you, and thank you for this book.
Well, hello, Anthony. It's great to be here. And thank you for giving such a great synopsis of what it actually argues.
well, we're going to dive right in and hear some of the details, because it's a great case you lay out and a really provocative one. So I want to ask you about this quote from Leon Panetta, who has served presidents as a White House chief of staff, secretary of defense, and CIA director. He said the modern presidency has gotten out of control. What was he referring to?
Well, I think he was referring to the whole panoply of things I tried to put my hands on. But basically, the presidential to-do list has gotten larger and longer and more complicated, and willing partners have kind of disappeared. That includes Congress, which has shrunk in its role for a variety of different reasons. And also, the public is no longer a willing partner, in the sense that the demands of the public have become so much more brittle in terms of what we expect from a presidency and a president. There's none of the cartilage in the relationship that allows a president to have the time to do things. The kinds of expectations we have for quick and fully satisfactory results have gotten so short, it's almost impossible to meet the expectations. So the to-do list is longer, it's harder to do, and the grading is harder.
Right. You're right. I mean, there's so many ways to sort of encapsulate the huge, sprawling challenges, but I'm just going to read one sentence from your book. You write, "No man or woman can possibly represent the varied competing interests of 327 million citizens." Then you go on, "or perform the ever-expanding duties of the office while managing an executive branch of 2 million employees, not including the armed forces." So that's the presidency of today. What did the founders have in mind 230 years ago when they conceived of the office of the presidency?
Well, you know, they did so in a moment of panic, because their first rough draft of how this thing was all going to go, the Articles of Confederation, had turned out to not work out very well at all. And in going back and doing my work for the book, which included lots of interviews with people who were practitioners, but also looking at the history, you see what a gamble this was to rewrite the rules after 10 years. And basically, they wanted to inject enough executive control that the country could react in a unified fashion to emergencies and to moments of national security peril. Also help connect the states with respect to the economy, so that you didn't have 13 different sets of rules for things, but that the role of the president would be limited. Sufficiently representative of the country to do things that only one body and one branch could do, but then would be very limited, and Congress would do most of the work. And that's where that notion of diversity comes in. You have people representing all the different kinds of parts of America and people in America, which gives a more durable cast to the laws that then govern Americans. And that was in the original conception of it. Now the idea that we would filter all of our public questions through the one president would just seem crazy to the founders.
Right. Now, as we mentioned, you make the case that the office of the presidency has become so vast, big, and complicated, too much for one person to handle. And we'll talk a lot more about how we got here. But I want to jump to the present with President Trump, because in so many ways, he's defied so many norms of the office. He's doubled down on division instead of unifying the country in times of crisis. And I know you're not making an excuse for him, that the complexity of the office is why he's the kind of president he is. So how has Donald Trump used or exploited the vastness of this office to become the kind of president that he is?
You're right. I'm not, when I say it's the hardest job in the world, I'm talking about it the way you would a brain surgeon.
Right.
And the results are just as awful when it's done poorly. And so this isn't an attempt to make excuses. It's an attempt to understand the office so that we can place credit or blame in the right way. President Trump has, he's basically not participated in many of the roles of the office, acting as a unifier in moments of national crisis or tension. He's actually seen political benefit in splitting the country. And that's not me saying that. That's members of his own party who've said it repeatedly. And this is moments of acute national crisis that we're in right now, but also just more broadly. He also has decided not to embrace the kind of more pastoral role or priestly role of the presidencies. He's also on national security, reshaped the way America operates in the world. Some people think that's quite good with turning his attention to China, but others obviously believe that by not maintaining alliances both in Asia and in Europe, he's left America deeply vulnerable. He also has a different view of working with Congress. He's put no real energy into any of the bipartisanship or deal making that we have usually associated with the office. Even if you were unsuccessful, presidents had to at least make a shot or make a go of trying to forge bipartisan compromise. To the extent that there's been bipartisan achievement in his administration, it has mostly been in areas where he's not been participating. So he's basically and I should say, finally, this isn't to say he has not been successful for those that brought him. Hmm. He has been among the most successful, and you could argue most successful, Republican president, cutting taxes, cutting regulations, working on behalf of those who are against abortion rights, increasing defense spending, getting lots of judges through the system, and also just bedeviling liberals, which has been something all of which conservatives have been looking forward to in a Republican president. So, but that also means he's abdicated the role of the president as the president of the entire country, as opposed to just the president of his political base.
Mm. So getting back to this idea of this sprawling and out of control presidency, you write the idea that this job has expanded year after year. It's not new. And that going back to FDR, he tried to reorganize the office in a very modest way, saying the president's task has become impossible for me or any other man. What did he want to do? And how did people react?
I spent some time in the book doing with the stories of history, because when you go back and look at all FDR was asking for was for a few aides to help him manage the Great Depression. Yeah. And there were marches in the streets, and the congressional offices were overloaded with hundreds of telegrams of people. They were screaming he was a dictator because he wanted to basically consolidate the management of the executive branch. He had to rely on aides who were loaned to him by the cabinet departments, which he didn't really even have control over, certainly not in the way we think of it today. Congress had control over all of this. And he was basically trying to say, if you want a modern response to the challenges of the day, I need more help in my pure administration. And this was enough of a scandal that people marched in the streets claiming he was a dictator. And by looking at the passion with which people pushed back against his simple request, and then looking at the office now, which is groaning with the number of aides and different departments, you get a sense of how much the executive branch of the presidency has grown and how much the Congress has shrunk.
John, I love this anecdote, this historical anecdote about FDR, because what he was asking for was so modest. I mean, it was like, it sounds like he was sort of saying, yeah, I need someone to answer the phones and, I don't know, bring me a couple of pens when I need them. I mean, he wasn't asking for a lot.
He wasn't. And they were absolutely, the Brownlow report, which was his request was based on, which is a commission, the Presidential Commission on Administrative Management, not exactly the most alluring title, was headed by Lewis Brownlow, who was a journalist and a city manager. And he was basically, he came up with the request that FDR made. And it is packed with all kinds of obsequious recognition of how limited the request was. So in other words, the Brownlow was saying, the president needs some aides, but rest assured, those aides will do nothing that it is very important. They will be like Victorian children. They will be seen and not heard. And so it was written from the posture of, we are supplicants to Congress, and the president is a supplicant to Congress. And despite his modest request, please don't think that he is trying to hone in on congressional power.
Right. So I want to ask you about a modern presidential responsibility that we take for granted now. In times of national disaster, the president is expected to show up, to become an on-the-scene presence and coordinator, hurricanes, floods, that kind of thing. But it wasn't always like that. And you describe how Eisenhower, for example, never got involved in a series of hurricanes that hit the country in 1955, right? So this is a sort of modern phenomenon and expectation.
Right. So, Anthony, what I did was, you know, in addition to interviewing people who were, you know, had been in these more recent administrations, I went back and looked at the past and sort of interviewed history the way I might a source. And basically what I was looking for is, where did this come from? You know, now whenever there is a fibrillation on the barometer, we all expect the president to rush over to FEMA and put on the windbreaker with the presidential seal and get briefings. And I was going back through the papers, and there are all these hurricanes in 1956, and Eisenhower is in none of the press coverage. In fact, what I found in one instance was, there was a great hurricane barreling down on the East Coast, and there's a whimsical little story in the paper about how Eisenhower's been on vacation for a long time, and Vice President Nixon is joking about the fact that they can all get a little bit more sleep. Hmm. The idea today that a president could be on vacation with a disaster looming, and then B, that it could be the subject of mirth, is just, it's just hard to imagine given the way that expectation has grown.
Right. John Dickerson, stand by. We're going to talk a lot more about your book. He's the author of The Hardest Job in the World, The American Presidency. We're talking about that. We want to, there's a lot more to talk about, including the role of modern presidential campaigns and how that is added to the challenge in the White House. Stick around. There's a lot more coming up. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the balanced scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the job of President of the United States and asking if it's become too big, too complex, and too besieged by crises for any one person to handle. John Dickerson is with me. He's a correspondent for 60 Minutes and author of The Hardest Job in the World, The American Presidency. And John, I want to just play some tape from past presidents speaking of sort of showing up and being a kind of national consoler in chief, a key part of the modern presidency. So here's President George W. Bush on his first visit to Ground Zero 3 days after the 9/11 attacks. While thanking first responders as New York City continued to smolder, he grabbed a bullhorn to give unplanned remarks.
I can hear you! I can hear you! The rest of the world hears you! And the people... soon.
And let's go back to 1986 when the space shuttle Challenger exploded 73 seconds after takeoff. President Ronald Reagan delivered a televised address hours later from the Oval Office.
We will never forget them, nor the last time we saw them this morning as they prepared for their journey and waved goodbye and slipped the surly bonds of Earth to touch the face of God.
And John Dickerson, you wrote that speech became instantly memorable because it transformed tragedy into meaning. And one more, the job of consoler-in-chief, not enumerated in the U.S. Constitution, but few presidents have embraced it, including Obama stepping outside of conventional bounds in 2015 at the funeral for 9 people killed in a South Carolina church shooting.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me.
President Obama there in 2015. John Dickerson, you wrote about that event as well. Tell us something about it and what you concluded.
Well, you know, President Obama, this role, you were asking earlier about disasters. This pastoral role kind of comes out of that. We obviously had moments where presidents in the earlier part of the presidency had to console a nation, but they were, you know, the Gettysburg Address is a single big major event. It's much more sewn into the office now, where there's a lot more opportunities for presidents to respond and play this role. And President Obama was down in Charleston, and the eulogy that he gave Charleston was the port through which slaves were brought to America, or more than anywhere else. And it was also the scene of this awful racial shooting. And he took the forgiveness that the families of the slain had for the shooter, and honed in on that idea of grace as a gift from God, as a way to address the horror of the moment, but also the legacy of slavery, which was at the heart of the shooter's evil shooting, and elevated the whole moment into a moment for everyone, white and black in America, surrounding this idea of God's grace. It was an act of literary skill in writing the speech, but then there was also that performative aspect, which you just heard in the song. And it was a way in which a president stepped into a moment of national crisis, of sadness, of absolute despair, and gave it meaning, which is what we all turn to leaders for in these moments. We seek some kind of meaning in these moments of madness.
Right. I want to ask you about when this changed, because you, when I say when this changed, I mean, we, before the break, we were talking about how President Eisenhower didn't get involved in a series of hurricanes that hit the country in the 1956. But that changed with Lyndon Baines Johnson. What did Johnson do that was new?
Well, you know, Johnson was always, he had this extraordinary talent for the ambient needs of politicians. And he was always reaching out, figuring out what someone needed, how to give it to them. And sometimes they needed a gift, sometimes they needed pressure. And he kept a kind of running constant list. And when Hurricane Betsy hit the Ninth Ward in Louisiana, he got a call from Senator Long, who represented Louisiana, and Senator Russell Long. And Senator Long basically said, please come down, that we're really hurting down there. And Johnson immediately starts to filter it through two political lenses. One is he knew that Russell Long, he'd asked Russell Long to do a lot of things, and he kind of owed him one, and he knew he'd need him in the future. But then he also saw an opportunity for this national stage for him to walk on it. And that's kind of where this presidential expectation comes for in the disaster responder role. Before there was television, there were not these national moments of televised drama where you have a storm or people recovering from a storm. Once there was a national drama on television, of course, it needed a lead actor. And the lead actor was the president. And so Johnson went down and visited the post-Hurricane Betsy destruction. And the famous line when he shows up was, I'm your president, I'm here to help you, which sort of encapsulated this idea of a president who's on the scene responding. And he came back to Washington, cut through the red tape to get help and aid down to Louisiana, got rave reviews in the headlines at the time, and other politicians noticed this. And this started the, along with television and then the creation of FEMA, started the national sort of obligation to respond, because before, not only did presidents not respond, but there was not an automatic obligation to help the people. The federal government would help rebuild the buildings, but it was seen that people were going to, should respond through their own local efforts to help after a disaster. And then that changed in the years after Johnson started this process, and then other presidents picked up on it.
Right. They picked up on it, and it sort of adds to their brief of responsibilities. And it gets to this idea that you talk about as the president as a kind of action hero. And isn't that what voters have come to expect now, in a way, which then will sort of lead into this whole effect of modern presidential campaigns and what they promise in their campaigns. But talk about this idea of the action hero president.
Well, it's basically the idea that in campaigns, candidates sell themselves as the solution to whatever the problem is, and that if you just elect the candidate, they will cut through all the baloney and get the job done. And on what issue will they act so successfully? Every issue, because of course they're promising different audiences everything. And so it creates this expectation for fast work by a single man in this case, because we've only elected them so far. And it raises this expectation. It is a part of what political scientist Brendan Nyhan calls the Green Lanternism of the presidency. And that is based around a DC Comics character, Green Lantern, whose power was directly related to his will and how much he willed something to happen. And we cover the presidency a lot in that fashion, which is if there's not a success, it's often marked down to the fact that the president just didn't assert his will strongly enough. But sometimes, and often, the systems of politics thwart a president, sometimes by design. The founders designed it that way. But so we have this mismatch between the expectations of the campaign, which is the superhero candidate who rushes in and can solve the problem, and then the reality of the job, which is much more pokey and slow and frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, I was really struck by this idea that campaigning, that you put in the book and you express so well, that campaigning has become about performance, and this requires a specific set of skills. But it's a very different set of skills that are required to govern, right? So how does this disconnect manifest itself in the modern presidency?
Right. Well, we you know, we were talking about the pastoral role or the priestly role of the presidency, and that's all about communication. It's about the sense of timing. It's about understanding the national need and mood. And those are campaign-related skills. But the problem is that while there is what happens in campaigns is we think that's kind of the majority of the presidential job. In other words, if something needs to be solved, well, a president can just give a speech and change everybody's mind. We have an image based on Lyndon Johnson's success that a president can, twist arms and get Congress to do what the president wants through willpower and force of personality. The structure has changed in Washington, so it can't be done that way. But presidential campaigns are about basically victory or defeat. No compromise, destroy the opposition. But governing is more about compromise. It's about taking what you can and getting what you can with a system where you don't have all of the power. And the campaigns also are about a single question. Do you want person A or person B? Governing is about making a case for a route in an atmosphere where it's not just option A or option B, but whether I pay attention to what you're saying at all. In other words, your healthcare plan, I may or may not like the elements in it, but first you've even got to get my attention, because unlike a campaign, which sits everybody down and says, okay, in November, you're going to have to make a decision. With legislation, the country can just basically ignore you and go about their day. And so it requires a set of skills to get the country to pay attention, then once you've got that attention, to sustain an argument, both publicly, but then also privately as you persuade. And those are all much more subtle skills than the kind of the slash and burn that we reward in campaigns.
My guest is John Dickerson. He's author of The Hardest Job in the World, The American Presidency. And listeners, what do you expect from the leader of the United States? What's the most important part of the job description? What could we cast aside? Let us know what you think. We're on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And John Dickerson, I want to introduce my colleague, Kimberly Atkins. She's senior Washington correspondent for WBUR. She's been listening along, and we're going to talk more about your book. But Kimberly, you've got some news that I want to talk about briefly. And also, John, I'd love to get your response to this. A Supreme Court ruling that will determine whether the House of Representatives and a New York prosecutor can subpoena Trump's accounting firm and banks for his financial documents. Give us the short take on this news.
Yeah, so in these two rulings, what the Supreme Court essentially said is maybe. It's kind of what you call a punt in this situation. Hmm. In the case involving prosecutors in New York in their attempt to get financial records from President Trump's accountants in an ongoing case there that stems from the Stormy Daniels matter, the court held that it ruled against Trump 7-2 in that there is no absolute immunity. The president cannot say, I am absolutely immune from subpoenas like this. But the president has to at his disposal the same sort of objections and he can fight them any way any other American can. He can say that they are too overly broad or launch other kinds of objections to this. So it's remanded down to give the president a chance to make those arguments again in the lower court. We'll have to see what happens. But in the meantime, the prosecutors in New York can seek from these accountants these tax documents. The question is whether or not they will be made public at any point in the future. In the second case, that involves congressional subpoenas against the president that were much, much broader for a number of matters. The members of the House of Representatives were saying that they needed this to conduct their legislative business. The president countered that it was not real legislative business, that they overstepped their bounds. The Supreme Court said, well, maybe the lower court really didn't do a good enough job of balancing that separations of powers issue. And it laid out a number of things that they need to consider, such as the breadth of this request and constitutional matters, and remanded that case down again as well for them to try again. Whether we will see these tax documents and other financial documents at all, let alone before the election, is a question mark today.
Really interesting. Kimberly, thank Thank you for that. John Dickerson, this, of course, has been an issue that has sort of bedeviled Donald Trump from the beginning. And it's sort of one of his kind of rule breaking things that he did by not revealing his tax documents, which every president, I guess, going back to Jimmy Carter, has done. What's your response to what you just heard about the news from the Supreme Court?
Well, as you point out, this is a promise that, candidate Donald Trump made repeatedly that he would release his tax returns and then has not. So the separation of powers question is interesting because it's part of those larger questions we've been discussing, which is where does the president's power begin and end and where does Congress begin and end? But that's we're not going to get a, you know, that's still to be worked out. On the question of what happens with the Manhattan District Attorney, what interests me there is even if the records come out after the election, there is now a calculation that Republican officials have to make, and it's one that they've often had to make in the Trump presidency, which is the information is going to come out. It may not come out before the election, but it will come out, much as the information about from John Bolton. Everybody knew it was going to come out, whether it came out in testimony or came out in a book. It was going to come out. And so Republicans who voted not to have John Bolton show up as a witness in the trial basically made the calculation, whatever shoes are going to drop in the future, I'll deal with them at the time. But right now, I'm not going to vote for witnesses. And a lot of those shoes dropped. And John Bolton continues to appear with more shoes dropping about what the president did, how he behaved. And then the question of those Republican senators is, you knew this was coming. You could make an assessment on the president's fitness for office. You chose not to talk about this in the proper setting. And what culpability is there for Republican officials? So now the question is, do Republican officials have to worry about what will come out after the election when this information comes out? And it might be benign. It might just be mildly embarrassing. Or in the most sinister vision of these tax returns, it might show a relationship between the president's public dealings and his private dealings that will show a misuse of office. Every Republican politician now has to think through that set of challenges,
really,
as well as voters.
Yeah. Kimberly, I know you've been listening along. We've been talking to John about his book, The Hardest Job in the World, The American Presidency. And the basic idea here is this office has become so big for any one person to handle. What's your response to this basic thesis that John's presenting?
Well, the office has grown. It has become so big. It is a difficult job. I would never want it. So I think that premise is absolutely true. But there is also this idea that I increasingly hear thinkers who I respect say that in the last several years during the Trump administration, in a way, we're seeing the office shrink in a way, in that the expectation from the president seems to get lower in terms of what we expect out of them in terms of behavior, in terms of leadership and other aspects of it. So I think it could, depending on how you look at it, go both ways.
That's a really interesting point. John Dickerson will pick up that idea after the break. We're talking about the job of president of the United States and asking if it's become too big, too complex, too besieged by crises for any one person to handle. John Dickerson is with us. So is reporter Kimberly Atkins. We'll be right back after a short break. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
You This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Tomorrow, it's our weekly news roundup. More than 3 million coronavirus cases across the country, a presidential push to reopen schools, a limit to student visas, and more. Tell us how the week in the news is affecting your life and your community. Give us a call at 617-353-0683 and leave a message. That's 617-353-0683. This hour, we're talking about the job of the U.S. president. With us is John Dickerson, correspondent for 60 Minutes, author of The Hardest Job in the World, The American Presidency. Also with us, Kimberly Atkins, senior Washington correspondent for WBUR. And John, I'd love you to pick up on Kimberly's point before the break, this idea that, you know, in some ways, if you look at the U.S. presidency, there's an argument that it's shrinking with reduced expectations, essentially, from the public. What do you think of that?
Well, I don't know if the expectations have been reduced, but the tools and abilities of a president have been reduced, because there's basically what the reason presidents have turned to executive orders and administrative actions is because they can't work with Congress because of partisanship or other reasons. So they can't create big, durable pieces of longstanding legislation, which limits a president's ability. And then there's also, so while it may have diminished in the actual things a president can do, surely, you know, and certainly on foreign policy, there's presidents have extraordinary power both to do things, but then also not to do things. President Trump's decision to abandon the Kurds essentially set the conditions for Turkey to move in. So that was not an actual obligation of forces, but a withdrawal of them that had consequences for a U.S. ally. I think one of the, and so it is absolutely shifting. And one of the things I tried to do in the book is say, what are the standards for the job? Where do they come from? By looking at the original blueprint, and where do we stand now? Because what's happened in the way we run campaigns is we rewrite the standards to fit whoever we want to be elected, whether it's an incumbent or a challenger. And so we design the job in a way that fits perfectly with whoever we want to hold it, and that means there's no standards at all. Everything is malleable in the moment, and that's not a very healthy way to run things, because standards are what tell us whether we're on the right track or not. And in fact, the Constitution in its original arrangement is basically a set of standards for the way the government should work in this collective agreement we've made in the American democracy.
I want to ask you about campaigning and campaigns, the modern campaign, and how this affects the issues that you're talking about. You write at a certain point that primaries encourage candidates to do whatever keeps the crowd in a roar. And a little later, you say Trump took this trend to its logical conclusion. Can you explain that? Because I know you've covered a bunch of campaigns. I have, too. And I'm always struck by, even as a journalist, how we sort of rate, you know, that was a really amazing campaign rally. But the question is never answered. You know, how does that relate to what the president, if he or she were to be elected, how he or she would actually govern after this fantastic campaign rally?
Right. Well, and you covered Vice President Al Gore. He's the one who gave me the idea. He talked about the presidential campaign as a job interview, which is what I spent much of my time in the interviews I did. Whenever I would talk to a former president or an official, I would say, if you were holding a job interview for the job, what's the first thing you would look for? And so I was thinking of it in that fashion. And it's never the case that anybody comes back and lists all of the things that candidates do in a campaign. They talk about things like priority setting and how to build a management team, stuff that we never hear about in campaigns. And what I tried to do in the section on the history of presidential campaigning is show how both the primary system basically made it about making the pitch to the direct pitch to the people, which has its advantages and certainly circumvents the back room, which was all about political fat cats choosing their preferred president so that they could keep their pockets lined. That was not a great system. But the other system, which is a purely direct election, has its disadvantages, too, which is that it ends up elevating somebody who can keep the ratings high. And Donald Trump speaks constantly, and still does, about success in terms of ratings, whether ratings were good or ratings were bad, which, again, when we think about the malleability of standards, is that a good standard for whether government policy is good and whether a president is doing well in office, their popularity, their ability to keep eyes glued to the screen? Or is it better to keep people out of hospitals? Is it good to have the warehouses stacked with protective equipment, or is it better to have high ratings on during prime time? And so the more that candidates were appealing directly to primary audiences, and again, primary audiences are the most virulent, the most ideological in political parties. So it exacerbated that move towards elevating the skills to appeal to the most faithful rather than the governing skill, which is how to appeal to the other side, how to appeal to the broad swath of America, how to understand the needs and desires and hopes and dreams of those people who are not in your constituency. Because the job as president is to represent everyone, is to hear and take seriously the complaints of those who didn't take you to Washington, and then address those within the powers of your office. If you can't hear those needs, if your campaigning for the office has conditioned you to not listen to those needs, then you come into the job without ears to hear what it's a part of your job to hear.
Mm. John and Kimberly, I'd like to sort of ask you both this question because, you know, you're both journalists, obviously, you've both covered campaigns, but to what extent do folks in our profession need to sort of rethink how we cover campaigns? Because, you know, I want to come back to this phrase you use, John, that primaries encourage candidates to do whatever keeps the crowd in a roar. And I would argue that as journalists, those are the moments that we are sort of most excited by and put in our reports when the crowd is roaring. So, Kimberly, what do we do about that?
Yeah, I mean, journalists, our job is sort of to be, in a way, the interviewer for this big job interview in a lot of ways, and to vet these candidates in ways that voters cannot because we have the greater access than they do. So it includes gauging things like support and enthusiasm that a candidate has. That certainly is a valid thing to look at. But it also includes vetting what the candidate has done, what he or she will or will not do, and what plans that they have. So it's really a multi-function task for members of the press has evolved over time. One thing I would love to hear from John is, I think a lot and voters and other folks talk about to me about qualifications, mm-hmm. whether or not a particular person was qualified for the presidency. And when we look at what the qualifications are, they were set out by the founders. And there are only three qualifications to be president mm-hmm. of the United States: to be 35 years old, it's to be born a citizen, and to win the Electoral College. That's it. So this is a big job, an important job, with very few qualifications. It was more qualifications for me to get my current job as a journalist. And so what do we know about what the founders intended campaigns to look like? They couldn't have envisioned what we have in modern times. But how is this sort of in line to them really leaving open this job in a very broad way for voters to decide whomever they want to be in that job?
Great question, John.
It's a fantastic question. And just to pick up on Kimberly's first point about covering these things, you know, we're there. We're covering the event. You know, here are some things happening, and well, I've got eyes to see it, and now I'm going to tell you about what happened. So we sort of, if you think of a plate full of food, we cover the dessert, and we also cover the vegetables, and basically our job is to get the order correct. But sometimes we're there just to cover the dessert, which is what a campaign rally is. In terms of what I was trying to do is go back to that original blueprint. What did the founders think about? Well, they had this great debate in the Constitutional Convention about whether there should be direct election of the presidency by the people or whether there should be some intermediating step. And what they ultimately fixed on was the Electoral College, in part because they were wrestling with the idea that you can't have direct election. And there's a fantastic debate because you had some of the delegates were saying you must have direct election because the people have a special wisdom. And they will have thought through what character and honesty and decency in the chief magistrate will entail. And they will, by picking someone directly, pick the most virtuous president. And then there were others who would say, having the people in charge of an election is like having a blind man tell you about color. It is absolutely antithetical to the kind of passions of the mob. They run it, rush in, come up with the Electoral College to put some sort of wise electors in between the people and the president. Now, this was also a kind of fast solution to bring in the southern slave states. So it was an accommodation of the moment, which in reading the Madison's notes of the time it was put together quickly. And the idea, as Hamilton tried to sell it, was essentially these electors would have special wisdom and know all of the obligations of the job and therefore pick people who were able to do it. So there are those three that are written down, but the electors would know what the job really required and therefore would only pick people of the highest character who could fulfill that job. That lasted not even till the election of 1800, when the electors started to basically act on the way their political parties wanted them to act and did none of this careful weighing of attributes for the job.
Really interesting. I want to read a comment from Twitter from Real World RJ. The comment is, maybe electing people on the basis of likability. The suggestion there, that's the problem. The guy we can have a beer with, that's the problem. You don't see businesses hiring a CEO because a person is likable. The media should reflect on how they cover campaigns and how they don't cover policies. But John, I want to ask you about this idea of likability, because clearly it's not enough. And I think too much is made of, you know, do you want to have a beer with this guy? But I mean, likability certainly has to be a part of it, because this is someone who you're going to be spending an awful lot of time with and who's going to be coming into your living rooms and kitchens via TV and social media and everything else for 4 or 8 years. I mean, how do you sort of think about and balance likability with qualifications?
Well, I think the comment from Twitter goes back to this idea of the diet, you know, and likability is one item on the plate. And it's important for two reasons. One, a president has to have a sense of the country, have a fingertip feel for where America is. And the great ones, Lincoln, FDR said, you know, or Lincoln said, with public opinion, without public opinion, nothing can happen. With it, anything is possible. And the idea was that the president needs a sense of where public opinion is. So a leader doesn't just run up the hill and expect everyone to follow. They have to have some sense of the country that there will be people who will be willing to follow them. So presidents are great nudgers of, and that's why the great reforms in America have come from the streets and not the presidency. The presidency's kind of catch up with where the country is, but a president has to have that feel for where the country is going in order to achieve greatness by leading the country there. So that's about likability. If you're an unpleasant person, you're not going to lead anybody to anything. But that's just one element of the job. And so if we overemphasize that element of the job, we don't pay any attention to all the other things that are important and that are necessary to execute on whatever your likable solution may be to get it done. To build power and build consensus within the governing structure of America requires a whole host of skills. Where likability is, or public likability anyway, is not so important.
We've just got a few minutes left, and you devote a good portion of the book about sort of how to fix the problems that plague the presidency. But before we get to that, I just want to ask you, what do we risk if we don't sort of think seriously about how to fix this problem of the presidency just being too big and too complex for one person to take on?
I think we risk, if we don't think about the presidency, we risk constantly being disappointed. And to the extent we're disappointed with the avenues through which we make public change in America, we turn to other methods, which is, you know, revolution, which is extreme actions taken. And that's the whole reason we formed a government in the first place, was to keep those things from happening. We also risk having one portion of the country constantly feeling like it's being shut out from the American dream, because they feel like the system is rigged against them. And we risk correctly arranging power in the American system to address the biggest challenges of our lives. I mean, the book was finished before our current sets of challenges, but the whole point was basically the presidency is a job of dealing with big, high-stakes emergency things that can hit you out of nowhere. And we're dealing with three of them at the moment. Now, not all of them were out of nowhere, but The fact is, if we don't have a system for handling these things, it leads to basically greater suffering and unhappiness on part of fellow Americans.
So what's on top of your list about, you know, an approach to resolve this? Because it seems like so many of these problems are so baked into our systems of campaign finance, our systems of campaigning, our systems of you know, the way the power has divided up and the partisan divide in Washington. What's sort of number one on top of your list.
Yeah, well, you're right. It is. And humility is one of the biggest things, which is, you know, we can't snap our fingers and fix this. I think one of the things is to not focus on the presidency as much as we do. Put more pressure on Congress, put more pressure on governors and local officials to do the things that we want done for our lives. So keep the presidential tasks narrow and then focus on where the failures are. It's not just a failure of willpower sometimes on a presidency. It may be a failure of the fact that they don't know how to build a management team to get the job done. And if that turns out to be a really important part of the job, then maybe we should talk about that in campaigns in some fashion. And so basically it's changing our expectations for what we think candidates should be skilled at so that they have a chance when they get in the job. And that means things like their ability to set priorities, their ability to build a management team, all of which I go into in the book, which is based on this idea that I asked all my interview subjects, which was, what would you want if you were doing a job interview for the job? And then the final piece is just, instead of thinking about attributes of a presidency as kind of all or nothing, instead of having a binary view about the skills of a president, recognize some gradations in a president's skills. And so we have a little bit more complex understanding of what the job takes. And the reason that's important is we don't just immediately throw out presidents who don't succeed in exactly the way we want them to. We recognize that it's a little bit more complex, which leads to maybe less disappointment.
All right. Lots to think about there. John Dickerson, correspondent for 60 Minutes. He's the author of The Hardest Job in the World, The American Presidency. Thank you so much for joining us today and for putting all these great thoughts, provocative thoughts on the table. Really great to have you.
Thank you so much, Anthony, and it was great to be with you, Kimberly.
And Kimberly Atkins, senior Washington correspondent for WBUR. Kimberly, thank you as well for joining us and for that update from the Supreme Court. We appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Great talk.
You can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big, whoa, kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.